You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, we got a twofer for you. First up, Joe Badia of Philly's Pizzeria Badia, which Andrew Knowlton named the best pizza joint in America a couple years ago. And we had Joe on the podcast back then, and he rejoins us to talk about how to make the best possible pizza at home, which is the subject of his new book, Pizza Camp. So Andrew and I and Joe, we talk about red sauce and white sauce, killer dough, all the toppings, but not too many toppings because you don't want too many toppings on your pizza, says Joe. And you can do this all without a fancy wood-burning oven. Just your basic home range will do the trick. And after that, I sit down with food director Carla Lolly Music and senior food editor Andy Barragani to talk about spring pasta. Whether you're cooking with asparagus or ramps or peas or artichokes, here's how to get all that, you know, that fleeting fresh green stuff into your bowl of noodles, butter included. All right, let's do this thing. Here is Joe Badia. Joe Badia, welcome back to the Bon Appetit Foodcast.
Thanks for having me.
Last time you were here, Andrew Knowlton, over to my right head, named your pizzeria the best pizzeria in America.
That's, that was pretty wild.
And now you're here to write talk about your book, Pizza Camp, which basically is telling people, hey, you don't need to wait in line at my restaurant for an hour for pizza. You can just make it at home and not come to Pizzeria Badia.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty simple process. Pizza dough, take some time to ferment the dough and then cook it in a really hot oven and you're going to have something delicious.
So what you're doing is not that impressive at Pizzeria Badia? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, it's a lot of attention to detail and a lot of pressure, I guess, in a way. But, it's like every night my goal is to make every single pizza, no matter who you are, sort of perfect in my own way. So that's a lot of pressure that I give myself. And then you have the pressure coming in from people. Like, for instance, this week, people are like coming in. It's like, after waiting 3 hours, they're like, is this going to blow my mind? It's like, I don't think so, but maybe. I don't know.
But for people who don't know Badia, Pizzeria Badia, it's in Fishtown. You're open Wednesday through Saturday.
Yeah, 5:30 to 10:30.
And you do 40 pies a night.
Right.
And no slices, no phone, no delivery. So it's like the ultimate pizza business plan right there. Right?
It's good for the pizza for sure. Yeah.
Andrew, having had Joe's Pizza, can you describe the type of pizza that you get at Pizzeria Badia and the type of pizza that Joe's sort of prescribing in the book?
Well, I think, when I first had Joe's Pizza, what I liked about it is this was kind of in the midst of the Neapolitan pizza craze, which is more of the individual pizza.
Kind of misshapen with big blackened things puffing and
ideally, yeah. But it was always the pizza was always kind of soggy to me, the ones I'd had.
Ooh, interesting.
And a little bit of wet.
Like when
in
you
the middle.
Pick it up, the middle sags.
There was nothing there. Alan Richman, who was a food writer, once wrote about how I was on the same page as him. We did not necessarily love Neapolitan style pizza, and that's all there was. And so going to Pizzeria Badia was this kind of, the stuff that a lot of us grew up with in the 70s and 80s, the kind of classic after T-ball going having a pizza. But elevated, Joe.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that.
Joe's like shaking his head.
No,
already.
That's fine. But that's like, exactly
on the,
right.
On the big aluminum round tray.
Yes. And I think Joe kind of brought in this new wave of kind of going back to pizza where it's more American style, where you have big slices. But then you kind of describe it as a hybrid where it's an American style pizza, but then the way you put the toppings on is very kind of Neapolitan.
Well,
way, right?
I don't know about how I put the toppings on. I think it's more of just the quality of things where a lot of times you'll go to these old school pizzerias and, they're using mushrooms out of a can and using kind of crappy cheese. So I think just to look at it like a chef would look at something in a way but still do the classic thing like pretty much to a T and just change what you're using. It just somehow like revolutionary in some weird way, even though I didn't really create anything.
I mean, what I love about this pizza and what I love about the book is that While I realize there's nothing simple about simple, you know, like it's the hardest thing to do, the perfect roast chicken, that sort of stuff. But this is something you can do at home as long as you pay attention to the techniques. So let's walk through kind of step by step how to make really great pizza like this at home. First step is the dough, which in the new issue of Bon Appetit, you write about this sort of a condensed version. And you apparently say, I don't have to make the dough from scratch. I can just pick it up at the pizzeria.
Well, I mean, there's like two ways. So like if you're not going to take the time to make the dough, you could go to your favorite pizzeria or a good pizzeria, some place that you actually like their pizza, mainly because the dough will taste good, and use that. Or you could buy Pizza Camp and make my dough, which I obviously recommend. And it's just really like a time thing. So it's like mixing flour and the water and just having that sit for, you know, overnight, let the flavor develop. It's not necessarily more work. It's just a little more planning.
You just got to be, thinking a day ahead. So if you're going to have friends over at 7 p.m. on a Friday, you get started the night before.
Or even Thursday morning or something. Yeah. You mix dough in 10 minutes. You cover it, put it in the fridge, and then the next 24 hours later, you take it out and you kind of roll it into a ball, let it sit again. And then as, you know, by the time you're ready to make pizza that night or something, it's ready to go. Just let it kind of come to room temperature. And it's going to just taste great and be a lot easier to work with. You'll be impressed with the flavor, but working with the dough will definitely take a little bit of time. It's not something that you can just tell someone. It's like a little bit of there's a little nuance and a little finesse there that, after, you know, practicing a few times, you'll get the hang of it.
But you've always told me that, I mean, just in terms of what a pizza is made of, it's 95% dough.
I mean, I don't know the exact, I always say like 99%, but yeah, it really is. I mean,
human beings are 82% water. I'm like, are we really 82% water? That makes no sense. And if you play golf, they always say trees are 90% air. You can hit right through them. I'm like, well, how come I always hit them? Yeah, that's a golf saying. Sorry, I digress. So, all right. So if you do buy the dough or make yours, store-bought pizzeria dough, you want to bring it to room temperature first, right?
Yeah,
so
if it's really cold, it might be, you know, hard to work with. It's also something that it's really just a feeling thing. So you can, like, if it feels like sort of tight and, you know, not willing to move, it just needs to sit out at room temperature, like covered with like a damp towel or something, or just covered in, you know, like Tupperware or something, until it feels like slack and like, I don't know the best words to use, but.
Andrew, you're an editor. You want to help?
It'll start bubbling a little bit and like.
Well, whenever I've touched your dough, it's silky. It's like smooth, like a baby's bottom.
Yeah.
Wow.
It really is. It's soft. And
it's the kind of thing that looks alive. If it doesn't look like it's alive, if it's perfectly smooth and cold, it'll be tight. So you really just want to give it a little time. I mean, honestly, it could take like 2 hours or something, but it's just something that you'll see and feel.
Okay, so you got the dough at room temperature-ish. We turn the oven on.
Yeah.
Our two questions. What temperature does your oven at your pizzeria go to?
I cook all the pizza at 600 degrees.
Okay, your basic home oven probably gets to 500-ish. Is that fair?
Yeah, mine actually goes to 550, but 500, you're going to make great pizza still.
All right, so turn the oven on as high as you can get it.
Basically, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't go above 600, but
okay, but most home ovens aren't.
Yeah,
and then I always wonder, where should the rack be? Is it middle? Is it lower? Is it upper?
I mean, generally the heating source is at the bottom, so I keep it towards the bottom without actually putting it on the bottom. Make sure you have a stone or baking steel or something in there.
You have to. That's non-negotiable. You
yeah,
need a pizza
I would.
Stone.
Yeah, I don't know how else you'd do it.
I do mine on a sheet tray. I can't do that.
You can absolutely do it on a sheet tray. It's not going to get as crispy as a pizza you'll get at a pizzeria, which is what you want. So you could do whatever, you know, you want. The results are just going to be a lot nicer with the pizza stone.
And if you have the stone in the oven piping hot, then you need the peel to slide that platter that sort of slides off.
Yeah, which is a little bit—
That takes a technique, right?
A little tricky, yeah. And you want to make sure that the—
What is the trick for getting it to slide off?
Oh man,
like that?
I'm still like nervous about it. Yeah,
well, like every time you make a pie, you get nervous.
Not nervous, but you're never. It's like being confident, but then also like not taking it for granted. Like you're just doing it. It's just, you have to commit, you know, and like you like sort of put it in the oven. You put the tip of it down, and then you just kind of give it like a little shake, and then it should just sort of like start to gradually come off, and then you just like gently pull the peel out.
But does the peel have a lot of flour on it when you're doing that?
I use semolina. People use cornmeal, which I actually hate. If you're really nervous about working with a peel, you're not confident enough, you could always make the dough on a piece of parchment and then kind of slide that in the oven, which will just basically come right off, which I probably should have put in the book. I'm just realizing that now, because that would be like really easy, and then you could just slip the parchment out and it's not going to give any flavor to the
Is there a particular stone that you would recommend buying?
There's a site online called like newyorkbakers.com, I think.
Yeah, nybakers.com.
Yeah, and they have a really nice stone, and I recommend, they have one that's 20 inches by 16 inches. Yeah. So you could sort of bake whatever you want
right
on there.
In the magazine for $65. All right. Yeah. So you got your oven ripping hot. You got your stone in there. You're rolling it. You take off a hunk of dough. You sort of shape it with your hands. All right. This is interesting. You say you need two kinds of mozzarella. Explain that.
So one of the best pizzas I've ever had in my life was from DeFara in Brooklyn. And he did that technique, and it created this thing that was so rich and delicious. It's basically like if you just use like shredded low moisture mozzarella, you're going to get what you get at every pizzeria like in America. And
when you say low moisture, that's what you buy at the supermarket in the plastic wrap.
Right, exactly.
Block.
That's shredded too.
That's pre-shredded. Yeah. And then this is like a hybrid where you have the Neapolitan thing where they're using fresh, mozzarella, and then you're using both kind of techniques, which just creates this like rich buttery cheese that marries with the sauce. It's like amazing. So,
all right, and I'm getting hungry. Well, let's talk about the sauce. Keep it simple, right?
Yeah, I mean the trick I learned from the pizza in Naples is that they don't cook the sauce. So it's a very, you buy tomatoes that taste good, get good canned tomatoes. I buy crushed tomatoes. You could buy whole tomatoes and put them through a food mill. Or just break the tomatoes up with your hands. Yeah. And really, you don't need to do anything to them. I marinate mine with some fresh garlic, a little sea salt, and extra virgin olive oil.
I think you definitely want salt. I think you want a little bit of salt.
A
in
little
there.
Salt, yeah. Or you season on the top, whatever. Yeah.
But talk about the garlic, because that's interesting that you put the garlic in there, but you don't cook the garlic. So then you've got raw garlic in the sauce. Is that true?
Well, yeah. I think of it as like marinated tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And then from there, everything, that's the whole point with the way they do it in Naples, is that you want something that's very fresh and bright tasting. So if you cooked it before you put it on there, you're going to end up with like a ragu, which is like thick and,
This is gnarly.
Right.
No.
With this technique, it's a lot less effort. And then you also get a brighter, fresher tomato sauce, which is awesome.
Do most of the pizza places that you've been to, like Great Lakes in Chicago or DeFara or Chris Bianco's place out in Phoenix, are most of them doing fresh tomato sauce and then just putting it on the pizza that way? Or
yeah, fresh from a can.
So the stuff I like and you like, that's what they're doing.
I don't know DeFara, but yeah, everyone else is.
Adam, when I was watching Joe make the pizza for the first time, when we were writing the story originally, the sauce was probably the epiphany for me, why his pizza tasted so fresh. And I remember you told a story about you called Chris Bianco, who's kind of the legend of pizza making in the U.S., one of them.
Yeah.
And you said, what kind of tomatoes should I use?
Yeah.
And Chris obviously makes his own now, has his own. And what did he tell you? He said...
He's a philosophical dude and he's an inspiration, but he basically said, I could tell you what kind of tomatoes I use, but they might not be the best tomatoes for you. It's like, I can't tell you what your favorite thing is. You have to decide and come up with that for yourself. So I just learned so much just from that. It's like, it's almost like you already know everything you need to know in a way. And so I tasted a lot of tomatoes, and I currently use the tomatoes that I really thought were awesome, which are the Jersey Fresh tomatoes.
He's like Pizza Yoda.
Yeah, he is.
Oh yeah,
Pizza Yoda.
He is. Yeah, he's the real deal.
Okay, let's talk toppings, because I think one of the shortcomings of many American pizzas is that they just put too much damn crap on top, and then it gets weighted down. And you pick it up, and the pointy part of the pizza slides off. And I'm like, and everyone's like, "Oh, let's get like seven things on your pizza. Like, let's get sausage and pepper." And I'm like, "No, what do you?"
Yeah, I completely agree. I can remember the first time I ate at Tafara, and I ordered one of his round pies, and the one half I ordered plain, and the other half I got the special, which was like sausage and peppers and onions or whatever. And the first bite, I was like laughing and crying. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it's so good. And then when I got to the special side, I was upset with myself that I had ordered it, because it was just like too much. It was so heavy. And like, I'm not really that much of a meat guy for pizza, but yeah, I love simple, and I like to sort of, as I'm making the pizza, I space things out in a way where it's not like every single bite is like a bite of pepperoni, because then it's just like, it's overkill.
So my question is, and this is sometimes I have gotten confused about this, in terms of what toppings do you pre-cook and what toppings do you put on raw?
That's a great question.
It is a good question.
No,
come on.
No.
I've been like, I've done ground sausage before, and I'm like, well, if I put ground sausage on raw, will the 500 degree oven cook that ground sausage?
That's the best decision you've ever made, is to put raw sausage onto a pizza.
Wait, I don't know if you're being sarcastic.
No, I'm absolutely honest. It's Mark Vetri does that at Osteria, and I think Pizzeria Vetri. And it's just so much better, because you're cooking, you know, in the 8 or 10 minutes, and it's like a tiny little piece of pork, so it's not,
you sort of take the sausage out of the casing and crumble it up.
It's so good.
And because all the fat renders
everything,
onto the
all the flavors on there.
Okay,
yeah,
I thought I had pre-cook it.
But at your pizzeria, you cook the sauce, you pre-cook the sausage.
I tend to cook the sausage at Pizzeria Badia like medium rare, and then put it on.
Okay.
Because you're essentially cooking it twice. So, you know, really only have to cook it once. My thing is, I don't want to handle raw sausage, because I can't always wash my hands. As soon as every time I handle it, I just wouldn't. The 40 pizzas would take like 9 hours.
Because Joe is the only employee at Pizzeria Badia.
But like, for instance, I'd love to put the greens on like the white pizza or red pizza for that matter. Spinach, Swiss chard, even collard greens, which are really, you know, sort of a tough, hearty green. And what happens is part of the green sort of marries into the pizza and, you know, softens, and the other part gets crispy like a kale chip, and it's just really wonderful.
Do you slick the greens with olive oil first, or you just put them on dry?
No, I just put them on dry, and then sometimes and I'll always season them a little bit with some salt. But
what is your take on kale on pizza? Because I know a lot of people, like my mom, who get very annoyed by kale. Do you think it's a good pizza topping?
I do, yeah. I like that. I like any sort of green on pizza. I don't know. I haven't really found any that I didn't like, so yeah. I mean, I wouldn't put like iceberg lettuce on a pizza, but
that's a terrible idea.
Remember in the 80s, that was like, was it taco pizzas or whatever they called?
Oh, there's so much.
When they would put like the shredded lettuce and cheese. Do you ever have that?
Well, I've had a BLT pizza. Good.
Cheeseburger pizza.
Yeah, but that was just putting iceberg lettuce dressed in buttermilk at the end of the cooking process with some bacon. But mushrooms, you don't cook those.
I would probably not cook. Yeah, you don't really have to.
Right.
No.
Just thinly sliced.
Yeah, I mean, you could saute mushrooms if you want to, but again, like we use cremini mushrooms, and they render out some liquid when you're cooking. I mean, it's nice to, if you have a really hot pan and you want to saute some oyster mushrooms and get them crispy and then throw them on the pizza, that's fine.
That's fine,
But I mean, you really, I'm trying to think what else you have to cook. Like, you know, for instance, we'll roast onions in the oven for, you know, an hour and a half and make really nice caramelized onions and put those on the pizza.
Ooh, I do that. Yeah. I'll sometimes do a white pizza with caramelized onions and ground sausage.
Yeah, that sounds good.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
And I think you do the same as they do at Emily Squared. Emily Squared?
Emmy Squared.
In Brooklyn, which make really good pizza. But they do, they always say they, what I like is they add the fresh basil after it comes out of the oven.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of elements of the pizza, you know, that I make and a lot of other good, you know, pizza places do. For instance, the fresh basil always after, just to you know, let it remain fresh and vibrant. Anchovies. You're using nice anchovies. I never cook them.
I'm not using nice anchovies. Well, I'm not using any anchovies. Joe.
Okay, that's well, yeah. You should use nice anchovies from Sicily, put those on when it comes out, and they'd sort of like meld a little bit.
Are these like the wonderful white anchovies?
Not white anchovies.
No. Is that too fancy?
That's like Spanish or something.
That's more of a cure, like a weird, it feels cooked in a way. Those are not good on pizza.
I actually hate those on pizza. Yeah. The Agostina Reca Sicilian anchovies are the ones that I use and I love them. They almost fresh out of the can, they almost taste like Parmesan. It's so rich with like umami. They're like amazing. Mm-hmm. So you know, I know in the article I wrote about how you treat the pizza sort of like a pasta dish, and that's the same thing. If you grate Parmesan before it goes in the oven, you lose all that nuance of the cheese. Where if you grate it on when it comes after,
I've done that before, and I'm like, why isn't this better? And so I should wait till it comes out.
Yeah.
Yes.
Pickled chilies, which are really popular at the pizzeria, I put those on after.
And those are like, is that like pickled peppers? You mean?
Like, yeah, I pickle serranos. You could use jalapenos.
It's like jalapenos slices.
But you can buy them in a jar. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Then you also, when the pie comes out of your oven at home, do you also do a quick drizz of olive oil over it?
Yeah, absolutely. Just a little bit of richness. You get some flavor from, you know, having a nice fruity olive oil.
But you mentioned the pasta comparison. I think that's when I first saw Dom DeMarco DeFara do it, and then you do it, Joe, is when it comes out of the pizza, you sprinkle it with a little salt if you want, a little bit of Parmigiano Reggiano or whatever cheese you're using, and then olive oil. That makes the difference.
It's like another whole other level of flavor. Right. I also do a little Sicilian oregano on our tomato pies at the pizzeria, just for some flavor and some like aroma, I guess.
Well, yeah, I like that. It's interesting that there's those two levels, like of it getting baked and taking the heat, and then the fresh cheese and olive oil and basil at the end to sort of waken it up is really nice. Now let's talk meats, because you were talking about mortadella on a pizza, which intrigues me.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I grew up with that I absolutely love, and which is weird because I was kind of a picky eater growing up, and it is a weird looking thing sometimes
also
for
known
people.
As bologna back when
yeah
we were growing
up. It's literally the original bologna in the world, and I love it when a hot pizza comes out of the oven and you just sort of drape it over top and the fat melts a little bit and then you slice it and it's really just a layer of like rich fat.
Yeah. So if you can go to an Italian market and ask them to slice the mortadella really thin for you.
Yeah.
And that just sort of, it sort of melds with the pizza. You can do the same thing with prosciutto, right?
Prosciutto, speck. I love because it's smoked. All those things are really, they're cured. They have such delicate, you know, wonderful flavor that if you cooked them, they would lose all of it. So,
But your point in the book, you even have somebody's holding up all these different meats and that you can see through them almost. Because I get sometimes a prosciutto pie and it's so thick that you take a bite of the pizza and it all comes off in one
and
big
it's
thing.
It's stuck in your teeth.
Yeah.
And,
nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that. So very thin.
Yeah. I mean, as thin as like delis normally slice stuff. Yeah.
But that's nice when you go to a place and you can ask, you can let them know, like, hey, I want that like razor thin. I have a feeling, I don't know if you're going to like this, Joe, but I oftentimes, when I make pizza at home, I'll do like the cheese pie and then I'll have like a little arugula salad with some little cherry tomatoes and olive oil and lemon in there, and then I'll take a bunch of that and put it on the pizza and do like a pizza slice, a salad slice.
I think that's great. I mean, I don't do it with a tomato, but I don't have any issue with it. I love arugula. We just got some wild arugula like a week ago for the pizza shop, and it's just so spicy and like it peppery. You know, you put it on when it comes out, it starts to wilt a little bit. Yeah. And it's like really.
I like that. I like when it gets a little bit wilted because arugula is still pretty assertive, but it can mellow a little bit when it's on the pie. Is there anything you just will not put on a pizza?
I'm probably not going to do some, you know, chicken.
You're not doing the buffalo pizza?
Thai chicken?
I like wings, but I don't want to put them on a pizza. I probably wouldn't. I don't know, like fruit and stuff.
You have pineapple in the book. You have a pineapple pie.
I do. It's just like, it's one of those flavors I grew up with, and I think I do like that. I've never actually made it at the pizza shop. It was just something for the book, but yeah.
I was in Buffalo this past weekend, where my wife is from. And in Buffalo, this is not at all surprising, but there, when you order the pizza, you get a side of blue cheese to dip the pizza in. You ever done that?
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, I like that. I don't serve that, but it's it's good. I'm trying not to gain any more weight, so I don't dip my pizza in cheese.
See, this past weekend I introduced ranch dressing and pizza to my kids.
See, I would do. I would ask for the ranch because the cheese is already on the pizza.
Oh, so blue cheese is that's nasty.
Well, yeah, because they have the wings. Most places that serve pizza also serve wings or vice versa. So if you go to like Anchor Bar, for instance, you can get pizza and wings and stuff.
Okay.
And you've got the blue cheese and you're just kind of, it's there. So why not?
Right.
You know. What about morning after pizza, cold pizza? Were you a cold pizza guy or do you heat up your pizza?
I actually, in my life, I eat everything cold. So if it's lasagna, if it's Chinese food, anything. I mean, I wouldn't eat eggs cold and I wouldn't probably eat soup cold. But beyond that, everything.
Yeah. It's interesting.
I'm not heating anything up. I don't use a microwave.
No toaster.
I mean, I don't own a toaster.
Oh, okay.
Not on any other
I have one question just because I think it's a question you're going to get a lot is Pizza Camp. Is the title of your book. And there's a funny story behind Pizza Camp. It was like a slur, wasn't it, to you?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. I mean, I was staging at Osteria, Mark Vetri's Osteria, when they, like, early on when they, I don't even know how long ago it was, at least 10 years or so. And contacted Chris Bianco. I was very early on in this idea that I was going to make pizza as a career, and I reached out to Chris and I said, "Hey, do you have any sort of advice for, someone who wants to learn more?" And they checked my credentials with, you know, Mark Vetri or something. And this line cook had some sort of apprenticeship that summer there. And for some reason, he thought I was like infringing on his territory, which I wasn't. I was, you know, just asking for advice, basically. And he came in one morning to the locker room as I was changing, and he said, "Pack your shit up. Pizza camp's over." So I was like, kind of. So I never went back, but you know, the chef there was, you know, he said that he had no right to do that, and you're welcome back anytime. But the guy was, you know, like he was employed there, so I was like, I'm not going back to.
See, and your Instagram handle's Pizza Camp, and your book's called Pizza Camp.
He's telling me where to go. Yeah. He's over it.
I will say that he brought a bottle of champagne into the pizza shop and apologized.
Oh, he did.
That was like amazing. Yeah.
And I have one more question. I'm going to put you on the spot. You've been making pies for 5 years now at Pizzeria Badia?
Well, 4 years.
4 years.
Yeah, 5 years. Of the year.
And people at home have to understand that, like, there's no, like, if Joe's sick or Joe gets drunk and doesn't show up at work next day, Pizzeria Badia is closed. You're the only one that touches the pizza.
That's
true.
Right, yeah.
So I've heard recently that if you want to go to Pizzeria Badia, you better make it soon because you don't think Pizzeria Badia is going to be around much longer?
Well, I have a 5-year lease and we just passed year 4. And for me, I feel like 5 years, when I get to the end of it, I'm not going to do 5 more years. Like, if I started cooking when I was 20 or 18, like a lot of, like, people normally do, I could probably go for 20 years, but I started when I was like 36. So now I'm 40 and it's like, I don't really, the hours are so, I mean, it's pretty grueling. And I also wanted to like, I also want to say like, I really love doing it and I want to continue to love doing it. And so thinking to the future, I'm not going to want to, you know, be there for 60 hours a week.
A, I love that we're breaking news on the Bon Appetit Foodcast.
Yeah.
B, do you think Dom at DeFarge is like, I don't know if I can go another 5 years. I'm 46 years old.
That guy, you know? That guy is a legend. If I could make him pizza one day, it would be a dream come true. And I don't know where. I mean, he's like 80 or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just not that, yeah,
so
driven.
So what's next then?
I don't know yet. I you know, something maybe involving pizza. I love the idea of making wine, but I don't know how to do that. So I don't know.
Not a sandwich, go, not just, a sub.
Just hey, I'm open to anything. I don't know.
How about wine camp?
Wine camp is great. Yeah. Oh, I'm sure we could get some people signed up for that.
All right, before we let you go, lightning round. Ready to do this thing?
Yeah.
Red or white?
White.
Got a favorite?
I have three. I don't know. I'm like really into Chenin Blanc, Riesling, and you know, some sort of champagne. So
okay.
Those right. are like what I'm into.
Flyers or Phillies?
Phillies. I've never been a hockey person. I didn't grow up with hockey, I guess.
All right. Rodney Dangerfield or Don Rickles?
Ooh, that's like that's a tie. I mean, I loved Rickles, but I grew up with Rodney. So I mean, I would have to say Rodney because I love Don Rickles. But yeah, Rodney.
Cheesesteak or roast pork?
Oh, roast pork, no question.
What's your favorite shop in Philly for that?
I tend to go to the Nick's in the Reading Terminal Market.
Okay.
Yeah. John's is also great, but I just like going to the terminal.
You just got back from a long trip to various places.
Yeah.
Thailand or Japan?
Thailand or Japan, no question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thailand wasn't for you?
No, I'm not. I'm like, you know,
You like order?
I like order, and Japan is the most extreme order. And Thailand is like, you know, such a wonderful place and great food, and the people are great. But, you know, you're swimming in a pool and there's trash floating down the river. Where Japan, it's like the complete opposite. So and the food in like Tokyo is like amazing. So, yeah.
Centipede or Galaga?
Oh man, I guess Galaga. That's like the spaceship one. Yeah.
So you're at the bottom of the screen, and the guys, the little bugs are like coming down at you.
What's it? 1942? Is that a game with the planes?
Is that really?
Game?
Was it propeller planes?
Yeah, yeah. I think that.
Oh, and then you could get two on the wings, like almost.
Yeah,
like
yeah, yeah. I love that. Anyway, yeah. My sister has one of those sit down.
Oh yeah, at her house.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's really cool. But that's and you can play like 20 games now.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
It's like
I don't know how
I feel
about that, but yeah, you can choose your
better.
Game.
It's better than Miss Pac-Man only. Because you have Miss Pac-Man.
I never liked Mr. or Miss Pac-Man. This was never my thing.
I like Miss Pac-Man
drives
better.
Drives me crazy.
What is the difference other than that, just like the outfits?
Miss Pac-Man, I think, was improved, an improved Pac-Man because they work through stuff. And there's a lot more going on in terms of some of the levels and all that. Plus, she has a bow in her hair, too.
It says, yeah. I think I already know the answer to this one. It says sardines or anchovies, but...
I mean, I love them both. Actually, for lunch and also in Pizza Camp, the cookbook, there's a recipe for smoked sardine, like, sandwich / hoagie. I get these really nice smoked sardines.
You know, that's not
sardines.
A pizza, right?
No, I know, but it's a good substitute for when you're tired of pizza. And it's, like, kind of healthier, maybe.
Last question, Nolton.
I think we've already asked Joe this.
Oh, we'll ask him again.
Let's ask him again. Last question. Butter or olive oil?
Definitely olive oil. I mean, I'm sort of, yeah. I love olive oil. I put it on everything. Extra virgin olive oil. I use the one from California. It's really delicious.
Did you say the one from California?
It's like California grown.
Olive California
ranch,
grown.
Arbequina
is the olive.
Yeah, I love that. I don't know. I grew up with butter, Lancaster County. It's like butter, you know, you keep it in your cupboard. And, Never in the refrigerator. And I love butter, but yeah, I'm an olive oil guy now. I need to be a little healthier.
All right, Joe Badia, thank you very much. Congratulations on Pizza Camp.
Thank you so much.
All right, that was Joe Badia. Now here is Test Kitchen editors Carla Lolly Music and Andy Baragani talking spring pasta. So you say spring pasta, and even without defining it, I'm immediately like, ooh, I like spring pasta. Like when I go to a restaurant, if there's something with like fresh vegetables and the pasta is kind of either olive oily or brothy or a little buttery, like that's what I want more typically than like the big bolognese or red sauce or whatnot. I want that fresh pasta, if you will.
Yeah. And it's not like you want bolognese in June.
No,
but no, not, you know, plenty of love for bolognese when it's your ribs time.
Well, I think what's so great with spring pasta is that you could showcase the vegetables in the spring, but also the pasta. It's not coated with heavy sauces, sugos or ragus. So.
Interesting. Yeah. I think it typically is, in my mind, it's veg centric, like pasta primavera. It starts with the vegetable, and that notion of like going to the farmer's market. It's finally warming up outside, so I guess my question, Andy, is like, yeah, how do you treat that? So say you go to the market, they have some nice peas or asparagus, some fennel or something. What are you doing with that to turn it into a pasta? Because like I do think there's different ways. Some things you saute, some things you need to blanch first. What are some basic rules in terms of taking just good vegetables and combining it with pasta?
Well, in regards to spring produce and how to incorporate it in pasta, I think asparagus, English peas, trying to think of other ones, they should be blanched ahead of time.
So sugar, sugar snaps. Or haricot vert, the little baby green beans.
Yeah. I had friends, I was at a friend's house last summer and they had a little garden. They had little baby carrots, which were really nice.
Adorbs.
And obviously you want to blanch those, or if you have radishes or something, you want to throw in there. Yeah.
Blanch ahead of time and then add it kind of towards the end because it's already pretty much cooked. So just to kind of warm through.
Yeah.
And then other spring veg like spring onions, green garlic.
Any greens
that are going to cook really quickly, I would just cook with the pasta, and the pasta cooking liquid.
So you got your sort of pan going with the oil, maybe some alliums or garlic. You get your pasta going in a well-salted pot. You're going to saute, like I said, whether it's some spring onions or some chard in there. Dump the pasta in with that.
That's very al dente.
With some pasta water.
Exactly.
So you're kind of tossing it in the pan. And then meanwhile, like I said, if you have these other veg that you've blanched and you're just blanching those in salted water quickly.
Yeah, I use the same pot as I would cook the pasta.
Oh, yeah, so, duh. Yeah, so you just do those before you put the pasta in.
Exactly.
Duh.
Yeah.
And then are you the type who shocks them in ice water afterwards? Or?
I do shock them, although I was taught not too early on.
Really? Meaning what?
I think
you're always supposed to shock, right, Carla?
Yeah, I mean, I always do.
I think it depends on the scenario, because I think if you're at home and you're doing this concurrently, you know, you've got your pan where you're building your pasta sauce and you've got the pot of boiling water and it's going to go, you know, the asparagus, say, if that's what you're blanching, is coming straight out of your boiling salted water right into the pan, then the pasta.
No, but it's not, I don't think it's going to, because you're taking the asparagus out and then you need to boil the pasta in the same water. So that's going to take 10 minutes.
But can I tell you what I do? I actually add the veg at the tail end of the pasta cooking.
Oh.
So the pasta's
doesn't get mixed up with the, or you just.
No, it does. It does. But
wow.
That's,
all right.
Yeah.
All right.
Your timing has to be.
Your timing has to be good. Yeah. But, you know, when you're talking about spring peas, asparagus, we're talking about a minute and a half, 2 minutes at the most. So
wow, you're blowing my mind. So all right, so you're like, all right, I know I only have about a minute and a half less of cooking time. The pasta's been in for 7 minutes.
Yep.
8.5 minutes is al dente. So you just throw in like the diced up asparagus, maybe some peas.
Yep.
And then you're taking all of those together with like a strainer or whatever and putting it in the pan.
Correct, Amanda.
Wow.
I love that. I mean, I wish
I never thought of it.
But if you were
you know what you should have done?
What should I have done?
You should have put that in Bon Appetit magazine. Because that's a great tip.
I need to, you know, diversify the information through all of our channels, right? These podcast listeners deserve unique information. This is for them.
Exclusive content.
We have so much.
Okay, so you've got, say, some peas, some asparagus. in with the pasta water, salted pasta water. Love that. Meanwhile, in the pan, you've got your sizzling green garlic or whatever, maybe some Swiss chard that's quickly sauteing. You're combining all that with some pasta water and some butter. Please say butter,
Absolutely.
Andy.
Absolutely. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's fall, winter, spring, summer. I'm finishing my pasta with a Napa butter.
And then you're just kind of tossing it like a restaurant professional.
Constantly.
With that elliptical sort of motion in the pan. Wow. See, I'm hungry already.
Yeah. Now, Me too. What, I keep thinking about one of the best spring pastas I ever had, and I hadn't thought about it till we sat down, was at Roman's like a couple of years ago. And it was like a true spring minestrone, but it had the little, these beautiful little, I think they're called anelli. They're like flat. They're kind of like ditalini, but they're very flat, like rings.
Okay.
Wait.
And all this spring veg, and it was a little bit brothy, and it just was amazing.
Well, I want to get to the broth thing, but you're saying minestrone soup, but
no. Well, they
you,
were
you
treating
did say
it.
Minestrone.
I did say minestrone, but it was a little soupy. It was somewhere in between. It was like pasta fagioli, but it was spring.
I want to get to brothy pastas in a minute, Andy, because I want to talk about your gnocchi. But so you've got this pasta, some little water, some butter, little olive oil. You got your fragrant alliums, your greens, and you have like your sort of blanched veg, like what we'll say it's peas and asparagus, all tossed together. Do you finish it with Parmesan cheese? Are you a no cheese? Like, how do you finish a pasta like this?
It depends on the pasta. So, like, sometimes it's Parmesan, sometimes it's Grana Padano, but yes, usually a salty, hard cheese. I think just about all of these pastas were finished with cheese, except for the cockles with the fragola.
We'll get to the cockles in a minute, young man. Carla, are you. See, I will do this, and maybe I'm guilty, but I don't think I'm guilty. I will do some cheese when it's out of the pan and in the big serving bowl. Because like when you put the cheese in the pan with the pasta, it sticks to the bottom of the pan.
Yep,
and
especially if it's been microplaned.
Yeah, yeah, so I'll take it out. I'll pour the pasta and all the nice saucy liquid into like a big serving bowl, so it's still piping hot. Then I'll fold in
some cheese.
The cheese. And then I like to hit it with the crispy, salty, fresh breadcrumbs on top.
Oh, yeah.
Great
Always.
Choice.
For some crunch to go with those crispy, fresh veg. Yep.
Love it.
I think you can use toasted nuts that way. You can use, you know, you can saute some.
Can we talk toasted nuts?
Please.
Absolutely.
Well, talk toasted nuts. What do we got?
Great. I mean.
I love hazelnuts.
Yeah, I
mean,
that's say.
Hazelnuts are one of my favorite nuts. Crushed almonds. It could be Marcone almonds. It could be skin on almonds. Pine nuts, some in your pesto, some coarsely crushed.
So what will you do? Do you toast them in a dry pan? Do you do them in the oven?
I do it in the oven.
So what do you do? Talk us through this.
350, depending on the nut. It could be anywhere from 6 to 8 minutes. Golden, fragrant.
Smell it.
Smell it, let it cool.
Yeah.
Coarsely chop, or if you're me, in a mortar and pestle.
Oh, boy. Anyways, and that's like another topping. And I think most people don't ever think about putting nuts on a pasta, but it adds a little richness and crunch.
Yeah, it's fatty, it's flavor, and it's texture.
I like pistachios.
I love pistachios.
Well, we know you love pistachios.
Yeah, love pistachios. I added to my my pesto this year. So.
I feel like every time you've been on the podcast, you've talked about pistachios.
And rice somehow.
Yeah. All right. So you have fresh breadcrumbs. Are you the type, Carl, that always has fresh breadcrumbs in your kitchen at home?
Generally speaking, yes. If I don't have fresh breadcrumbs, I definitely have stale bread.
Yeah. You're one step away. Yeah. I feel like we always at the Rapa Buck House always have. You buy some loaf of bread that you intend to eat and you don't finish it and it's just sitting on your counter. Then you're like, oh, well, at least I can just throw that in the Cuisinart.
Yeah.
Blitz it, throw it in the oven.
Preferably before it's rock hard. But
I don't always have stale bread in the house, but I do always have panko.
I was going to say. Yeah,
I do love my panko. It's
So if you're going to put, and I love panko also because I love a chicken cutlet. If you're going to put panko on a pasta, will you saute it in a pan with a little oil first to brown it.
Exactly. A little bit of olive oil, maybe a little bit of garlic, and then season with a good amount of salt and pepper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little bit of lemon zest.
Butter? Ooh. Why wouldn't you toast them in butter?
Or in butter, yeah.
Well, I mean, you don't need to, do you? I mean, like, listen, I mean, everything, yeah, sure. But you don't, I mean, olive oil does a trick.
Yeah, but
right?
What's the diff?
Well, it's just, they're different fats.
Sure. It's buttery, though, and you've got, if we're comparing it to cheese.
Yes, it tastes better with butter. I mean, like everything's better with butter. Okay. But yeah, so I like that crunch. I like the nuts. I love veg. You know what's also nice? Actually thinking like one thing I did enjoy when I made this, the quick riff fresh spring pasta at my friend's last year. And it literally went into the garden. It was just like, what do they have? Mm-hmm. And throwing a little carrots, which having a little carrots in there color-wise, getting a little orange to go with the green.
I'm having a really hard time with the carrot.
I'm really having a hard time. I'm really. It's like it's taking me to a dark place.
I'm like trying to remember.
You might have had a hard time going to Noma for the first time and eating Rene Redzepi's food because you're like,
are you comparing carrot pasta to eating at Noma?
Ish. Yeah, I'm just saying you have to open your mind to something new because you're like, oh, carrots don't belong in pasta until you put them in pasta.
I said I'm having a really hard time with the carrots. I've never had it. I'm like trying to think about what it would be like. The only time I put carrots in a pasta is when I do Mario Batali's his like basic tomato sauce as a carrot.
But that's you chop it up.
Yeah.
But this is different. This is carrot.
I know.
That's the problem.
This is as one of the starring ingredients. And okay, another thing, for instance, I would not put slivers, like sort of bias cut carrots with like spaghetti, but I would put it with some ziti,
Or well, rigatoni. All the same shape rules.
Penne rigate. So if you have a penne rigate and then you have some pieces of carrot and asparagus that are relatively the same size, and all of a sudden it makes sense together.
It makes sense.
And you're like, and unlike, I would then probably do the carrots a little longer than your peas and asparagus because the carrots need to cook a little longer so they're more tender.
They should.
You know? Listen, I'm an equal opportunity veg
interested.
Veg employer. I'm
going to play around. If you think pasta fagioli and there might be some carrots in that, then that could be a way in for the carrot. But I would do something spicy with it.
I would
because
want
they're
something
so sweet.
Sweet, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, say in the garden, you might have some chilies,
You just never know.
Some chilies.
I wanted to talk about cheeses again.
Okay.
Going back because we talked about the hard cheeses, the salty cheeses, and then that took us into salty toasted nuts. And Andy even did like crumbled crispy bacon and guanciale. But I also like a fresh cheese with the pasta. So like even in a pesto, instead of finishing it with more parm, a spoonful of ricotta or like as you put it out on the table and then you toss it in, it
warms
it up.
Is ricotta even really a cheese?
It's a fresh cheese,
I mean, it's just like cream. It's just you're adding creaminess.
Sure.
It's good. But but it doesn't, but you can't, you can do the ricotta if you've already done the Parmesan. Because you need that salt, you need that sharpness.
Yeah. Another example.
Why not just put more butter on, Carla?
Would be ricotta salata.
Love ricotta salata.
Which is salty, but also sort of crumbly and has that like fresh, like the, the goats were just around grazing in the spring grasses.
Yeah. I love mascarpone.
Mascarpone.
Oh,
I mean, I mean, one of the pastas that I made, it's mascarpone is basically, the sauce starts out with that.
Which one is that?
It's torn pasta with mascarpone, hazelnuts, crushed chilies, artichokes. Yes.
Beautiful.
Yeah. I'm the way you guys are about carrots, I'm about artichokes. I don't want artichokes.
My God.
I'm so sorry to hear that. That's one of my favorite things.
No, well, you've never, ever mentioned that before. What do you mean?
Artichoke pasta.
That is not a thing. I mean, it's kind of a thing. Like when you get like the olive oil and artichokes. Like
exactly.
At Bar Pitti, they do that.
Yeah.
And look, that's the lamest pasta.
You go to restaurants around Rome, you'll see a ton of pastas with carciofi. And a lot of it's usually made with baby artichokes where there's no choke.
But sometimes I even get globe artichokes, and it's like that's love.
No, you know what's
good? That's a lot of love.
You know what's good when you go to a restaurant and you get like if you're in Rome, like Andy Garagani just hanging out, and you get the carciofi Judaica, the little crispy artichokes, and then you get a pasta after that.
That's fine.
That's because the crispy artichokes are better than any of these.
I would love a crispy artichoke.
But I make mine crispy. They're crispy and super tender and garlicky and parsley-y. All right. Well, you can make your carrot pasta, and I'll make the artichoke pasta, and then
See. All right, because it's spring veg, we have to talk ramps, which America loves ramps these days. I love ramps. If I go to the market and there's like tons of ramps and they're affordable and they're super fragrant. I'm just sauteing those in a pan with oil, throwing the pasta in there, toss, finishing with some cheese and breadcrumbs.
Absolutely.
Like, I don't need to do any more than that, do I?
I always separate the leaves from the bulb.
Oh, yes.
I do that, yeah.
Okay. Good point. Talk about that for a second.
I mean, I just think they cook at very different rates.
Yes.
And the bulb, you want to get tender and it can get caramelized and it's got such a great oniony flavor. And with the leaves, you can chop them into fat ribbons or
leave them whole. And then
so start caramelizing the bulbs and then at the end throw in the leaves just to wilt and then toss in the pasta.
Yeah, they could get a little color. They kind of puff up, you know, when you get a little color on them.
I do like, I mean, something like ramps, I you don't need to overcomplicate them. They're in season for like, what, a month or so?
Yeah.
On the East Coast, maybe? I don't know. I mean, you see them everywhere, but
they
it's
were
like,
around this weekend, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Fort Greene Market had them.
Yeah, but it's just like, just play it simple. You're not going to have them that much. Just, I don't think you have to do a lot to
them. Yeah, I would treat them like aglio olio, you know, and use that instead of the garlic.
A good amount of olive oil, finish with butter, salt, pepper.
They take chili well, too.
A lot of chili.
Oh, chili.
Yeah, chili's great.
Chili. Yeah, you want some bite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can we talk pesto?
Absolutely. Love.
I'm sick of people telling me to make carrot top pesto. It's like, I don't want carrot top.
I don't want carrot top.
I don't want carrot. You know what carrot tops are? I hate whatever. Listen, I don't want to be that guy that's like poo-pooing stuff. But it's like when you're at the market and they're like, you get the carrots with a giant carrot top.
Yeah.
And the cashier was like, would you like us to take this? I'm like, yeah, go ahead, take the
top.
I don't want the carrot tops. I don't want to make pesto with that. I want to make basil pesto or ramp pesto,
Even mint pesto. Give me a chive pesto. Ooh, give me ramp green pesto, kale.
How often do you mix greens for a pesto?
I do it very often because sometimes like
– like whatever you got.
Yeah, with like ramp pesto, like you're going to need a lot of ramp. So I need a kind of buffer or I want some – if I want it to be extra green, I'll add just a handful of spinach just to make it extremely green.
So let's talk – so with pesto, your basic pesto Genovese formula will be basil, pine nuts – oil, garlic, and then some Parmesan cheese.
Yes.
Talk to me about how loose and easy are you, Andy, with in terms of subbing out different nuts, subbing in different cheeses, you know?
With the cheese, I really do try to stick with Parmesan. I mean, I wouldn't mind Grana Padano. I know we both share our a mutual kind of dislike for Pecorino, so never any Pecorino. Yeah. With the nuts, definitely, you could play with whatever.
Do you use pistachios in this one?
I use pistachios in this one, but you could go with the classic pine nuts. You could
walnuts
go with
are great
walnuts.
Too. They're so fatty.
Yeah, walnuts are a popular one.
Yeah, walnuts are delicious.
They have good fat.
But why? I find walnuts, oftentimes, if you eat them straight, they can have that tannic quality.
Yeah, they can.
But they don't in a pesto? You don't think that comes through in a pesto?
No, I mean, I think if the walnut is tannic like that, it could be a it could just be turning a little bit, you know? They should be sweet and meaty.
Yeah.
The thing I like about them is they're not as brittle as an almond or a pistachio, so they blend really well.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, so they're almost like fattier.
Yeah.
Whereas an almond is a lot of crunch.
Yeah.
But a pistachio is also nice and tender that way.
True. I mean, what I really like to do with just about any pesto I do is I'll take some of the elements and include them in the pesto, but then include them in the pasta and finish them. So like if there's pistachio in the pesto, I'll do some crushed pistachio on top.
On top. And that crushed pistachio will be of a bigger chunk than the ones that are ground in really well.
Yeah.
I always like with the pesto. So if I'm making pesto, and I do, because I'm a big pesto guy.
You are.
I love any greenish pasta. I will have made the pesto or whatever. I'll take a big scoop of it, put it in the bottom of a serving bowl, making my pasta. Then I'll take a little bit of the pasta water to sort of loosen it up, right? And then I'll just toss in the pasta, toss.
That's the way to do it. I mean,
and finish with
pesto
some Parmesan
should
cheese.
Never hit a hot pan.
Yes,
it should always be. It's. I can't think of really any other pasta where you're cooking. You're not cooking it. You're not assembling it in a pan. You're assembling it
in a bowl.
Large bowl.
Yeah.
With a little bit of the pasta cooking liquid.
Okay, can you help
toss,
me?
Toss.
Can you help me out here, Andy Berrigani? Because you're a restaurant industry professional. I feel like, let's just take your classic pesto Genovese. Sometimes I make it and it's bright green. Sometimes I make it and it turns out army green, and I don't know what I'm doing wrong
on
those times.
Probably the hot water, though.
But are you starting with raw basil all of the times? Because you do like that blanched basil method.
I've done that method before, which I picked up in Liguria. But where you blanch the basil first to sort of preserve its color, and sometimes that's a pain in the ass, though, and I don't want to deal with like blanching it and then squeezing it.
So this problem is really a raw basil.
I guess so. You don't have that problem ever?
So
does it always turn out bright green when you make it?
I tend to blanch my basil.
Okay.
I will add a little bit of parsley or a little bit of spinach, which you won't even taste, just to make sure it's green. And I always make my pesto in a blender. I want it super smooth.
Mr. Mortar and Pestle, are not using a mortar and pestle for your pesto?
No.
Really?
No.
You know, pesto means pounded.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's shocking. I like the parsley thing. Like I pretty much, I'm sure I always have parsley in my fridge.
A little bit. And it's just going to ensure that it stays green.
You know what's nice about parsley? Like a good flat leaf parsley? It lasts a long time
Fridge.
Especially if you seal it up in a Ziploc bag.
Basil does not.
No, basil's gone like in
like
a day.
A day. But
gone
do
in
you
60
make
seconds.
Your pesto in a blender, a Cuisinart, or what?
I would say Cuisinart, it's too big, you know, and
in terms of traction
and it cuts, it doesn't blend. I would say typically a blender. Obviously it depends where I'm at, like if you're at a beach house and you'd use what they have, sort of thing.
I mean, you know, herbs turn brown when they oxidize, or that's one of the biggest things. So even a dull knife and you get too much surface area. So the order that you put stuff in the pesto, I think, is important, like starting with the garlic and the nuts and the cheese and getting those all going. So if you added your herbs, then I could see how they would maybe heat up even in the bottom of the blender if they're blending for too long, and that would make them go.
Wait, so you're saying I should do what? So I've got the blender
start
going.
With your pine nuts or whatever nut you're using, the garlic, clove, and the cheese.
Okay, blend
and
that.
And get those guys all... And happy, then, really small, bitsy.
And then throw in all the basil with the oil.
Yeah.
Right? Because the oil then coats it and sort of it seals it in, I would
think. Yes, and I would also run the knife through the basil a few times before I put it in the blender just to give it – so it doesn't have to be in there for as long.
I mean, if I'm going to do it at home, and granted I don't have too much space, but the first restaurant I worked at, they would pound the pine nuts – until it's very, very finely ground, pretty much paste-like, and then pound the garlic until it's a paste. Combine those two. Again, add the basil. They wouldn't chop that, but they would blanch it. And then they would add the oil.
I just feel like when you blanch the basil, you lose so much of the aromatics.
Yeah, it's true. Maybe combine some blanch, some not.
Carla, we were emailing this morning about talking points for today's show, and you... casually referred to, that aglio olio thing where you put the salad on top of the pasta. And I was like, what? What are you talking about?
I love pasta with salad on top.
Not pasta salad, but with salad. But explain.
Maybe that's the way around pasta salad.
Pasta comma salad.
So aglio olio is like one of my favorite pastas, just garlic and oil. So simple. It's so delicious. Lots of parsley. I always put cheese on mine. I love that.
Sounds good so far.
It's great. So you have your hot, piping hot pasta, and then instead of cooking the tender greens, so I'm talking about your most tenderest things. The
is that a word?
Tenderest?
Yeah.
It is now.
Tenderest is the heart. Okay. So yeah, what are we talking about here?
I would say pea shoots, lamb quarters, like Andy was saying.
Let's say you're not a fancy food world professional. You just want to buy. So you're saying like baby arugula.
Baby arugula, a young lettuce. Like, just go with me here.
A little tender lettuce.
A little tender lettuce, but it could be Boston, just cut up. And you could dress that with like a tiny bit of lemon juice. I wouldn't even put oil on it. You have your hot pasta. You put a pile of greens on top, and then as you eat it, you're tossing it around. The greens are getting in there, and they're just going to warm up.
Wilting.
They're
going to
wilt, but keep a little bit of the bite. It's like so green. It's fresh, and you don't need a salad plate. And you don't need the salad plate.
Andy, the other day in the test kitchen, you were shooting a video for this gnocchi that you make, a ricotta gnocchi, which got cut from this story that you did in the magazine.
Yes, the recipe's online. But
let's blame Alex Grossman, our creative director.
We fought about it.
I think he didn't like the photo or something. What was it?
I don't know. I guess he didn't. Sorry, Grossman. I guess he didn't like the photo.
Don't worry, he's not listening. No, it wasn't that he didn't like that photo. It's that he liked this yellow better.
It was too similar to another photo.
It was too similar.
Anyway, those are the decisions you make when you're on a magazine. So what I loved about this gnocchi is that a lot of times when people have gnocchi at restaurants or make it at home, you do like a little potato gnocchi and the little dumplings, and then you toss them like in a tomato sauce or like a little, you know, pork ragu sort of sauce. You had it instead in this very light broth.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So let's talk about the gnocchi, how you make them, and then I want to hear about this broth.
So these are ricotta dumplings, and I was first exposed to them on how to make them when I was at Estella, so probably about 4 years ago. I learned them from Ignacio, the chef there, and he learned them from the legendary Judy Rogers of Zuni Cafe. I believe they're still on the menu. They've been on the menu for over 2 decades. She learned it from her time when she spent when she was in Florence. And they're just made with ricotta. Some grana padano, salt, pepper, a little bit of flour, an egg, and an egg yolk. Barely comes together. And then you could pipe it into kind of half inch pieces.
Can we talk about the key to gnocchi so often is using enough flour so that they bind, but not too much flour so they get dense.
Barely.
So how do you, what's your advice for people in terms of knowing what that right ratio is or when it feels right?
I think when you're in the stem mix, when you're whipping it in the stem mixer, you'll see the ricotta mixture just kind of pulled away from the sides. That's when you know it's kind of ready to go, where you've mixed it enough.
And you're gradually adding flour, or do you dump it all the flour in at once?
No, I'll dump, mix the ricotta, the Parmesan, the salt, pepper, and then once that's combined eggs. With the eggs, mm-hmm. then I'll add the flour.
And you add it gradually?
All at once.
Because you know what the ratio mm-hmm. is at this point. Yeah.
Anyone reading the recipe will have access to the same information.
At bonappetit.com. What are these gnocchis called?
Ricotta dumplings.
Ricotta dumplings. Yeah. Let's say you don't have your KitchenAid stand mixer. Can I do this by hand?
You could do it by hand. Yeah, that's pretty hardcore, but really? You could definitely do it by hand.
You're a strong dude. You can handle it.
They didn't have the ladies in Florence. Yeah. I don't think they did have a stand mixer.
Okay, so you have this mixture, it's just coming together, and then how do you form the little footballs?
What makes these really special is the way they're formed. I use a kind of just like a dinner spoon, and I take a little bit of the batter, like 2 to 3 teaspoons, scrape it against the side of the bowl, and then I use my index finger, dredge in a little bit of flour, and then just kind of push the ricotta dumpling off the spoon and flick it onto a
wow.
Yeah, floured
it's almost like
sheet.
I would love to see like a video of this.
Oh, in a few weeks. It's video. These amazing kind of almond-shaped dumplings that puff up like twice the size when they're simmering.
And how long do they have to simmer for?
Once they get to rise to the surface, about 3 to 4 minutes.
Oh, right. Okay, yep. So that's how much time total, I think.
Total, yeah.
Oh, and then when doing gnocchi like this that seem a little delicate, I imagine you don't want too much of a boil, or is it more?
No, it's and in this recipe, I would like a gentle simmer. Mm. You don't want a rapid boil by any means.
They'll break apart. They also have like this really cute little divot in them. Mm-hmm, it's like mm-hmm. when you push them off, they're like, imagine like going off the bottom of a water slide, and they end up with a little curve, like almost like a, I don't know, lima mm-hmm. bean.
I like divot. Okay, so you've got these tender, light dumplings.
Yes.
What do you do with them?
So I wanted to do something lighter because it's spring. I thought I wanted a sauce made with chicken stock. So a very light chicken stock, you know, use homemade if you can. If not, store-bought, low sodium. And I bring that to a simmer. And then I add the dumplings, a little bit of green garlic, just raw. Doesn't need to be salted.
So you have like a pot or a little pan of the chicken?
A little pan. I do like a large skillet if you're doing
refrigerated. Okay, large. So the dumplings are already cooked.
Cooked.
You've got simmering
stock,
chicken
simmering.
Stock. What else goes in there?
And then green garlic. Raw. That's fine. And then I'll add the dumplings. And just that kind of, you want it to be brothy. It's not going to be a glossy, sticky sauce. You want this to have a good amount of broth. And then I'll add some asparagus that I've had already blanched beforehand.
Slice
thin. You don't have to use asparagus. You could use whatever kind of veg you like. And then once that comes together, I'll finish with some butter.
Yeah.
And top it with more olive oil and some pepper and Parmesan.
Do you hit the olive oil after it's plated in
after
a bowl?
After it's plated.
Those little droplets.
I love the droplets. Mm.
Herbs on that?
Some chives.
Chives. Yeah. Chives. That's what I was remembering. Chives.
Can I say one thing about pasta? It's like, you know what? Like, it kind of drives me a little crazy when people want pasta to be healthy. It's fine for pasta to be meatless, like you were describing, delicious. But I was at Italy the other day over here, and I was at the meat counter, and I was getting some lamb chops, and there was a nice young woman next to me who was making spaghetti and meatballs. Mm-hmm. So she was getting meatball mixture, and they had this one of the many displays there was for like a red lentil pasta made out of red lentil flour.
Right.
And she was like, is this better for me? Should I buy this? Like, is this better for you? Like, isn't this healthier? I'm like, but it's like you're eating spaghetti and meatballs. You're making pasta and meatballs. She's like, but doesn't it have more protein? I'm like, the meatballs have enough protein. Yeah. It's like, this is not your time to be healthy. No. Like, you can be healthy the rest of the day, but if you're making pasta and meatballs for dinner, just get regular pasta.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it doesn't have to be healthy. And the same thing with this, like, you have beautiful vegetables, you've got delicious dumplings. It's okay to add some butter and olive oil.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, this is not about counting calories at this point.
No, you know? You can have some lentil soup with some little meatballs in it. Mm-hmm. Knock yourself out.
Yeah, but
it's like, it doesn't have to be pasta.
I'm sorry, I just kind of went on a rant tour. I was like, what are you doing? No, just buy regular pasta. And it's the same thing with this. It's like there's a difference between aesthetic and calorie counting and fresh and delicious. And like you can have fresh, delicious vegetables and still be a little indulgent with your fats.
I'm like, it's all in moderation. So, and I also just, I know that gluten gets a bad name these days, and a lot of people really do have trouble with it, but this is a beautiful food based on it's a wonderful food. It's flat.
Yeah,
my feeling is, if
you're gluten intolerant or celiac, I get it. But if you're not, it's like it's not about eating a different alternative pasta. It's like, well, just don't eat as much carbs and gluten the rest of the time. But if you're gonna do pasta, embrace it. Indulge in it. Same thing with good pizza.
Yeah.
You know, that is not the time to skimp and save.
No, and I totally believe that it can be healthful. Those are healthful ingredients. You put a lot of other veg and herbs and a protein-rich chicken stock, and like, that's a great meal.
It's delicious. It's not low calorie, but it's delicious and fresh.
I eat a pound of it.
Oh, I am.
Well,
we had this whole thing a few years ago, Christine Mahlke. We were doing a thing, and she and her now ex-husband, I'm just going to bring this out of there. We're talking about pasta servings, and they're saying, oh, yeah, 4 ounces, three to four ounces per person. And I'm like, that's bananas. If I'm eating pasta at home, I'm having more than 3 ounces of pasta.
I mean, I'm having more than 3 to 4 ounces, but the way we do it at Bon Appetit is we suggest 3 ounces.
Yeah, but that's one serving. But that's like, I'm not having, if I'm making a good pesto pasta at home, I'm definitely having 2 servings. And then when I'm doing the dishes, I'm finishing the rest out of the big
bowl. But you're also eating that as that's your main course. That's your dinner.
Yeah, but this is America. That's what we do. We don't do a primi or a secondi.
And so in Italy, you would have that, a small amount of pasta or a smaller amount, but it wouldn't be the end all be all.
You would then have your
meats. Yeah, you would have your meat or your fish after that. So it's dinner when it's your main course. Like, I have to weigh the pasta if I'm making it for myself because I can consume.
You can't stop.
It's a large amount.
Can't stop, won't stop.
But I weigh out like 5 ounces just to make sure I don't have less than that.
On the flip side, I am for. It's interesting because I guess I like carbs. But on the flip side, I love a cheeseburger, but I don't need like a 8 ounce cheeseburger. I find that excessive.
No.
I would much rather have like a 4 ounce cheeseburger smashed and get all crispy and my cheesy and my toppings and condiments, and I'm fine with that. Like I'm going less meat, more other stuff these days.
Totally.
Is that okay?
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
Believe in that. You know? I think these support that.
And
as
these
well.
Are also in this is the what is this is oh in the April issue of Bon Appetit, which is off stands now, but you can find this on the newsstand and in the bonappetit.com, these recipes. And all these, are they all meatless or is there any like crispy pork?
There's some
guanciale and there's chicken.
Where's the guanciale in?
There's guanciale here.
In the pesto?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Oh yeah, before we go.
The chicken ragu.
Can we talk chicken ragu?
Yeah, absolutely.
That piques my curiosity.
So I think it was I wanted to do a lighter kind of transitional pasta dish, so something that you could make when it's still maybe a little chilly outside.
Because spring is like that.
Because spring is like that.
And spring chickens. But I had to be convinced, too. You pitched this, and I was like, really? Chicken ragu? That sounds gray.
I wanted to start off kind of with like a classic ragu with aromatics, but I wanted to switch it up. So rather than onions and carrots and celery you might find in a sugo, I decided to go with kind of onions and fennel, garlic, cook that down. I use boneless, skinless chicken thighs. I cook that up, brown that up, deglaze it with some wine. And then
White wine.
Yes, that's another thing. I decided to go with the white wine rather than red wine. Just, again, making this whole sauce lighter. Yep. And then remove the chicken, the brown chicken. It's not cooked through yet. It's just brown. I'll sweat the aromatics, and then I'll bring the chicken back in and start building the sauce, adding the sauce, the stock, And then cooking that until the chicken's cooked through. I'll remove it, let it cool, shred, still let the aromatics going. Add the chicken back in, add milk. Which is kind of a classic. You add that
and
to
it. And bolognese. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I wanted to make it a little bit richer. And then, so you have your sauce kind of ready to go, and you can make that ahead of time, 2-3 days. You have your pasta boiling, very al dente, and then you add the pasta to the sauce, bring it together. I had some peas and fennel fronds to finish.
I like finishing with the fennel fronds. I think that's one of those things. Fennel fronds are, they look beautiful.
They look beautiful.
They're fragrant. Yep. And it's also one of those things like, well, if you, so often people, you take the bulb and they chop it and they either mandolin it for a salad or they roast them or whatever, and then they just kind of forget about the fronds. And that's such a nice finishing touch to bring it back to the basic.
I love that kind of feathery mouthfeel too that it has.
And it's not dill.
And it's not dill.
It looks like dill, but it's not.
Carl Ali Music, Andy Baragani, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
So fun.
Bye-bye.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Emma Wertzman and Carrie Polis and edited by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys, with additional music by Nathaniel Wertzman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.